Hello and welcome to the Label Sessions Presents podcast. Label Sessions is the world's leading innovation expert network. In this series, you will meet some of the most interesting leaders anywhere, from across the worlds of business, design, tech, culture, and sustainability, all signed to the Label Sessions roster. To find out more about our work, helping brands and institutions around the world take on their big challenges for the future, head to labelsessions.com to find out more. For now, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to the podcast, Johnny. Thank you so much for coming on. You know, we know you at Label Sessions as someone who's, you know, a strategic generalist who's guided, you know, some of the world's biggest brands through their, you know, innovation challenges. You know, we've talked a little bit before in the past, and what I've really picked out is kind of you're almost humanizing the future of innovation, which is something that is pretty cool, but also pretty hard to do. So, you know, thank you for coming on. Hopefully we get some kind of insights and see kind of what you're up to. But I guess first things first, would you be able to share with us a little bit of an introduction to you and kind of, you know, perhaps explain your work in your words and the backstory that gets you to this point?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks very much for having me. So I guess by way of introduction, I suppose I've always worked throughout my career, I've worked kind of in and around this, what is frankly a very strange world of kind of corporate innovation. And I guess what I do there is, I think in its simplest way, is I help big companies move faster. So to try and go and do new things that they wouldn't otherwise do and do those as fast and as cheaply and as kind of risk-free as possible. So I think that's what I do in a nutshell. Maybe I'll give a bit of a sort of potted career history if that's interesting. So I began life as a quite traditional strategy consultant. So working in quite a small boutique consultancy, but focused on sort of technology and media companies. So people like Intel or the BBC or Adidas maybe as well. Kind of big companies like that, but focused particularly on kind of tech and media kind of briefs. And doing it more from a kind of, I suppose, strategic and analytical lens. Classic strategy toolkit. So I did that for a couple of years at the start of my career, and then kind of decided, well, A, I wanted something more creative, and B, kind of then just found myself falling into this world I'd never even knew existed, actually, of innovation consultancy, which certainly I had never heard of. I suspect quite a few people perhaps haven't. And I've always been in that world in and out kind of ever since. So I joined what is one of the sort of the big, or certainly at the time, one of the big innovation consultancies called What If in London, and then really doing, I suppose, a range of different things. I always think of innovation as a spectrum, really, of kind of different types of innovation, because it's such an overabused word. It kind of means nothing in and of itself. But the kind of type of work I was doing at What If was anything from, if you think it down this end of the spectrum, the more incremental, the more tactical innovation. So that'd be, you know, classic NPD, so new product development. You know, think, you know, working for Cadbury's, what's next year's kind of flavor of chocolate bar going to be? So, which is sort of fascinating work to do, but, you know, relatively incremental in the sense of the levers you've got to pull are relatively kind of limited, right, in terms of what you can change about the product or the business model. It's primarily kind of, you know, feature-driven innovation there. But through to the other end of the spectrum, which is much more kind of white space and open-ended, where you can play with a whole lot of different levers that might be working for someone like, you know, Castrol, for example, who were thinking, you know, sort of back in the day, so say around 2010, for example, they're asking, well, hang on, what do these entirely new vehicles called electric cars, well, what does that mean for Castrol when there's no moving parts in an electric car? Or sorry, there's no requirement for engine oil lubricant in an electric car. Well, hang on, what does that mean for a brand like Castrol if some portion of, you know, car fleets go electric over time? So trying to think, well, hang on, what skills and competencies have they got, and what do they move into? So kind of working across that spectrum, both doing projects and also training others in doing that kind of work and thinking that way and building their own kind of creative muscles. So that was something I did, I suppose, consultancy side for a long time, both first in London, where I'm from, as you can probably tell from my accent, but then kind of halfway through moving out to Asia, I decided I needed a new stimulus. So I wanted a new adventure. So I moved out to Shanghai and they're doing, you know, a similar role and similar type of work, but obviously in a totally different context. So trying to understand the Chinese consumers, the Asian consumers, and also Chinese corporates who increasingly kind of became the corporate client base. So we'll talk about that later if that's of interest. So that was kind of the end of my consultancy career. Then I decided, well, hang on, I've been a consultant for too long, so I wanted to move client side and go kind of in-house into big corporates to help, to be able to tackle these things that previously you're advising on and you're seeing, you know, from afar. So then I joined a big financial services company called MetLife, who, and at this time, it's interesting to me how the innovation is. It's always different trends in the act of innovating itself. At that time, it was all about innovation labs, which, you know, since have got something of a checkered reputation, it's probably fair to say. But at that time, they were all the rage. So I thought, okay, let's join an innovation lab and see what that experience is like from the inside. All, and, you know, all the good bits and the bad bits. So I spent 3 years with MetLife in an innovation lab, helping build that team. And again, doing two things. One is running projects. And there the kind of brief was saying, well, hang on, we've got all these customers and this brand and this channel and frankly all this capital. Well, what else could we do with it? What are the adjacencies we can go and move into? So trying to run experiments and launch new businesses around that. And then the second piece being around culture change. So how do you help people act differently? And, you know, really there, I suppose, asking questions of, well, you know, for you've got 10,000 life insurance workers in Japan or perhaps in Korea, what do you want them doing differently? What, you know, what does leadership actually want to see them doing and behaving differently and you know, hopefully what results they want to see achieved? And then, okay, how do we, what change do we then want to enable? As opposed to jumping straight down the sort of the risk of innovation theater, oh, everyone should, you know, go and, you know, become a design thinking expert, which, you know, is a useful methodology, perhaps not the answer for everyone. So I did that for a long time and then moved into what I've been doing most recently, which is joining Dell Technologies. So, you know, I think everyone will know Dell, obviously, kind of for laptops most famously, but working across, you know, many different aspects of kind of hardware technology primarily. So for the last 5 years, I've been based primarily in Singapore, but in a global role helping oversee Dell's kind of innovation remit. So running innovation teams and strategies to say, again, kind of what's next for Dell. And again, back to that spectrum, that's from the incremental, you know, what are some features for next year's laptops, through to what are some new categories we can move into, through to, you know, oh, what are some concept devices we can design and prototype and then show at the Consumer Electronics Show, for example, to help build kind of Dell's reputation with the press, with analysts, with brands, and then potentially productize some aspects of those concepts. So that's the role I've been doing most recently, but left at the end of last year. So now just at the start of my own journey in terms of building my own thing, which I think to begin will be a bit of freelance work, some fractional roles, and then see what those evolve into, be that other people's ideas or my own. We shall see.
I think that's super exciting and something that's kind of, you know, the different stage of your journey. But you must be seeing so many kind of, or exploring so many different avenues and topics and stuff like that. You know, the future is quite a big place. And there's kind of a lot of things that you could creatively think about. But I guess, you know, what's exciting you right now in what you're doing, whether kind of that's a topic or a way of innovation? You know, what are the new opportunities or challenges that are emerging that you think might be important for kind of your work and, you know, for everyone else and their work too?
Yeah, so I think there's so much to talk about, so kind of we can steer it in different directions as we go. I think perhaps I can talk about it with a few different hats on. So I guess most I spent the last 5 years, you know, think about consumer technology and kind of computing, for example. So we can talk definitely with that hat on, but also I can talk kind of more broadly kind of across sectors. And as you're hinting, I think the kind of the act of innovating as well, particularly from that perspective of, you know, within, you know, large or relatively large companies, how do you affect change? How do you actually going to achieve different things? And I think obviously AI is going to come up a lot in our conversation. I think that is inevitable given the moment we're in. But maybe I'll try and make sure it's not all exclusively AI. But if that sounds good. So maybe I'll start with, I guess, yeah, consumer technology. So what I've been thinking about for the last, you know, kind of 5 years, which, you know, affects, you know, I'm interested in as an industry, but also affects all of us because, you know, all of us are using technology, you know, on an ever more intimate basis. So I suppose one of the areas I'm particularly interested in at the moment is, well, like I said already, you know, clearly the impact of AI, which everyone is thinking about, clearly. LinkedIn is, you know, a never-ending stream of, you know, people's qualified or not opinions on it. But I suppose what I've been thinking about AI most recently is the experience of using it. So not, you know, what is not kind of the race for the most powerful models, but actually, what is it like to use AI and what is going to get more people using it? Because that is obviously the trend. But it's fascinating how patchy adoption has been to date. So, but to start with, about the experience, I mean, to think about the devices we use, I think it's interesting, you know, AI has given us these amazing abilities, right? So these kind of superpowers. And yet here we are still using, you know, the same mouse and keyboard we've been using for 40 years. And you know, we're still stuck, you know, primarily anyway, in this kind of not great chatbot interface that has been around for a long time. So to me, that's going to be the next kind of wave of innovation, and obviously kind of agents and agentic AI, which I know is a big theme right now for many people, will be a big part of that. But how the experience of AI becomes more natural and more usable, I think will be what actually drives the next wave of adoption. So that is, you know, from a technology point of view, that's thinking, okay, how do we go beyond the chatbot? How do we truly embrace voice and sight, and just simply more natural ways to interact, because AI is multimodal. You can have much more human interactions with it. And I think what then gets interesting is, well, as a sort of side effect to that, as it becomes more natural, it also starts to feel less like AI. And actually, we'll probably start to call it AI less. And actually, it just becomes technology or software or a service. And, you know, kind of, you know, spell check being the classic example of that. In a sense, that's you know, an original iteration of AI. No one thinks about it as such. It's simply a feature of the, you know, the word processor I use. That will increasingly be, you know, the way we think about AI as it matures, you know, as it becomes baked into the things we use more and breaks out of, you know, the kind of the currently classic anyway text chatbot interface. So I think that's one way I'm super interested in anyway, the way we interact with AI and how that will evolve. The impact on our devices also then becomes really interesting. How do literally, you know, our smartphone, our PC, our laptop, how do they change over time? And this is an area in what hardware might evolve. And that's an area we're seeing a lot of experimentation in right now and a massively high failure rate. So just, you know, I mean, CES is in a few days' time, but certainly thinking about, you know, kind of technology, you know, over the last couple of years, you've seen things like the Rabbit and the Humane Pin, obviously Apple's Vision Pro, a lot of innovation happening in the hardware form factor space, and inevitably with a very, very high kind of failure rate, but some of that will work, definitely. And I think it's that intersection of AI and spatial computing that will actually get really interesting from a form factor point of view and actually be the next wave of device innovation kind of over and above, you know, the smartphone. And, you know, perhaps the best example of that right now, if you've seen the Meta kind of Ray-Bans collaboration, it's an amazing bit of technology. Actually, and you know, it's a gorgeous experience that clearly is AI driven, can provide great value, although those use cases are definitely emerging. It's still sort of in a bit of that kind of novelty phase. But what perhaps is most interesting, so from my point of view, is for good or bad, it's normalizing the idea of having a camera on your face. And again, yeah, you can say that's good or bad, but you know, in a way, Google Lens tried and failed, what, 2011, you know, over a decade ago. That whole glass holes kind of reaction, this, you know, that wasn't socially acceptable then. Actually, Meta and Ray-Ban aren't having that reaction now. And actually, increasingly, this idea of us being augmented by technology on our person, whether that's in our ears or sitting on our, you know, on our glasses or elsewhere, becomes more and more socially acceptable as it becomes A, more useful, and B, simply just more embedded. We see more people using it. So I'm certainly interested in kind of form factors and that next wave of device innovation for both kind of work and life. And you know, again, Apple Vision Pro launching that space last year, huge buzz this time a year ago around that. Has it been proven as a commercial opportunity? No, probably not. Certainly not. But then I don't think that was ever Apple's intention. But they are certainly seeding the market and seeding the intention. So again, I think as AI and spatial compute come together, that gets really interesting. So that's one area, and you know, can happily talk more on that. Or I thought I'd dive into, I suppose, the act of innovating as a topic.
Yeah, that sounds good. Sounds good to me.
Cool. All right. So I guess it's such a fascinating moment in time we're all in right now, because, you know, very simply, the act of innovating has never been in some ways easier in the sense of the ability to explore and to create and to build. You know, the tools we have at our disposal are amazing and will clearly only get better. So the possibilities of what one person sat at their own desk and build right now are, you know, bigger than they've ever been and will only be bigger next year. So, and that is, it's just, you know, it's astonishing the toolkit that we have, whether you're in a big corporate or one person sat behind their desk. There's never been this better time to build, to code, to learn. That then gets interesting. And again, you can think about it both in the corporate perspective, where you've got corporates making big investments, desperate to get people adopting AI in their workforces, but also terrified of moving. It's a fascinating balance. They want to spend the money, but they don't want to move too fast. Or they do, but they don't want to open the sort of can of worms of, oh, sure, anyone can use any AI tool. You get these kind of corporate IT policies coming in the way as well. Corporate adoption of AI is at this fascinating moment in time. And, you know, I've spoken to so many friends in corporate life recently who've, you know, the leaders of their company have made very big investments, maybe, you know, 12 months, 18 months ago in AI. And at the time, that was accompanied with very positive internal messaging about how we're doing this to make everyone's jobs better, you know, to help make each of us more productive. But now, 12, 18, 24 months later, those same execs are saying, well, hang on, why can't we cut our workforce yet? Why have we got the same number of people? So there's a really interesting challenge there, both in terms of the adoption they want to drive and that they are not yet seeing, and also then the impact on, again, for good or bad, clearly the shape of the companies they want to build. And maybe we can come back to that in terms of corporate adoption and what it means to use these tools in corporate life. But it's really interesting what changes about the shape of companies at the corporate level, but also at the startup level. You know, one person can build anything right now. You know, I spent the last couple of days playing around with, you know, coding and Claude or Replit or Lovable, these wonderful tools that let you build apps. And I'm not from a technology background, I'm from a strategy background. So it's amazing what I can suddenly do. So I have this ability to build that I never had before. What shape of startups does that then enable? And you get, you know, you have this people increasingly talking about, well, what, you know, you can now have one man or 10 person, you know, startups in a way you never could before. Again, so the shape of a startup could start to look very different, which I think is fascinating. Again, what is the shape of companies, big or small, going to look like going forwards? Obviously, there's a flip side to that lovely ability to build, which is so can everyone else. So then you get into this world of, well, hang on. Okay, great. I can explore. And there's some wonderful tools for kind of insight collection and gathering, you know, that are emerging right now. And I can build in ways that I never could. And potentially I can scale in ways that I never could, but what's my competitive moat? And again, that's true as a startup, but increasingly perhaps, you know, with some bigger companies, what they previously assumed were their competitive moats might not be so deep anymore, put it that way. And then, well, what does become your competitive moat if it's not the idea, which, you know, ideas are relatively easy, and if it's not the ability to build, to execute, well, then it becomes more about, you know, distribution. And I think, again, timing as well. So how do you then build that brand and own that customer distribution channel? That then becomes your moat. And implicit in that is also the ability to keep on evolving and keep on changing. So I do think it's this fascinating moment in time, both for corporates, for startups, and, you know, as myself, if I'm going back into this world of consultancy as well, what are the tools that all of us are using that allow us to move faster, but also to build that competitive advantage, because I think it looks very different.
Yeah, and I guess kind of with that, you've talked a lot about the kind of the what's that could be happening and also kind of the hows. But I guess, you know, a question that I have to you then is, you know, what are the conversations that you have been, or like, what are the things that you've been thinking about that perhaps you think that, you know, people should be conversing about more? You know, what conversations should people be having in your field that perhaps they're not picking up on yet, that you think is or might be super, super important kind of coming up?
Well, I mean, I think we touched on a couple already, perhaps. One is definitely what I think we're just talking on, which is understanding this changing role of competition going forwards. So, and again, what keeps you competitive in this new world where building is that much easier? And again, I think distribution will be the key, in which obviously certainly big corporates, you know, have that. They've got that brand recognition. They've got that channel access and, you know, their sales forces. But again, how does that evolve? So I think understanding the changing nature of competition, also understanding, well, what are the different mindsets that we need within a corporate to innovate are. So that is both, you know, the kind of classic dual mindset kind of thing, where this ability to focus, yes, on today's business and optimizing for that and kind of keeping the lights on, but also to think, you know, quite differently potentially about tomorrow's business and kind of where is value going to come from and be protected, or what it's going to be protected by kind of in the future, and how you bridge those two, which is always the kind of the classic problem in corporate life, which is, you know, you cannot have sort of distant innovation teams kind of trying to dictate to the core business what that core business should be doing. You know, that never works. But how you balance those kind of two mindsets, I think, is so interesting. And again, particularly at this kind of moment in time as it's evolving. So I think that's definitely one area I'm very interested in, and kind of I think that's one of the topics leaders increasingly should be talking about, should be thinking about. Another would be around, well, what are the skills that we need in-house as, you know, as corporates? So what are the specialisms we need and we need to protect and to cultivate, but also what new skills are going to evolve, right, and going forwards? And, you know, I mean, it's so interesting, perhaps I'm biased in this as a bit of a generalist myself, but it's very interesting to think that if increasingly one of the key skills certainly going forward is going to be the ability to speak human and to communicate, right, and to persuade and, you know, prompt as well, or certainly at this moment in time anyway. But it's really interesting, some of these new emerging, well, not new areas, I suppose, but the increasing importance of some classic soft skills over and above, or certainly in complement to, the more traditional hard skills that have been prioritized, you know, certainly historically in kind of corporate life. So I think one of the skills that we need a really interesting topic for leaders. Another would be also, I think, and we touched on it earlier about in terms of the impact of AI and kind of how that shapes workforces, but there's a clear barrier right now in terms of adoption and kind of what is genuinely kind of shifting the needle at scale in terms of impact. And this moment in time we're in right now, which is, well, hang on, people having spent lots of money in terms of investments and having, you know, heard all the hype they have for the last 2 years, not yet seeing at scale the impact, perhaps. Plenty of exceptions to that, but kind of in general. So what will shift that? And, you know, part of that is definitely thinking about AI adoption, not so much as classic digital transformation, you know, the sort of thing, you know, the Accentures of the world have been selling for the last decade or two, or even thinking about it as a training job. If I just throw more training at the problem, that will fix it. If I teach people my AI, you know, more about AI, but actually think about it in a different way as a behavior change. And actually the very kind of different approach I think you need to adopt to kind of solve for that. And think, well, hang on, what are those different behaviors that are going to be needed, and how are we going to encourage those so people actually get hooked on AI and are bringing it themselves into their own workforce in the right ways. And also, I guess it's so interesting, in a way, we're kind of at the minute at the kind of the skeuomorphic phase of AI, in the sense of at the minute we're just applying AI to existing workflows, and definitely there's efficiencies to be found there. But actually, you know, what gets really interesting is when we start to reinvent workflows to be AI first. And again, how do you do that in these big companies with very established processes and very established workforces? It's those who can truly drive behavior change around that and kind of AI first workflows.
Well, I was just going to say, the stuff that you're talking about just now, you're talking about, you know, humanizing kind of this innovation that's going on, but also kind of, you know, the way we adopt things and the way the almost the behaviors and the ways of thinking around it. It's something that, you know, we've talked before, and I definitely see you doing kind of a new kind of being a leader in that respect, about all of those things. And, you know, I just wanted to ask if it's something that, you know, you take particular pride in that part, the kind of the humanizing part of it and the kind of bringing the soft skills into it, or, you know, how would you want people to describe you as a leader and kind of how you make change happen? Kind of, is it that aspect of it, or is it something else that you always kind of ideally would want to highlight?
So I think that's a huge part of it. And I think anyone who wants to work in this kind of innovation, this innovation space, which is fundamentally, particularly again in a corporate context, which is about affecting the behavior of others, I think you have to bring that kind of human element to it. And I think it is those soft skills, both to understand, both kind of throughout the innovation process, really, both to understand, well, what's going on and why, you know, kind of getting to that differentiating insight, and in terms of actually finding the interesting kind of solution and what will work going forward, and then going and making it happen, right, in terms of embedding it and getting driving people to it. That's a very human thing to be doing, actually. So I think that's kind of that kind of empathy it takes, I think, is an essential kind of part of the process, definitely. I guess what else do I try and bring whenever I'm, you know, in whatever context I might be in? Definitely, I think it's that humanity, it's that softer side to innovation, to technology. But I think it's also, I suppose, perhaps three other things I think of. One would be definitely around an ability to kind of join the dots, because I think certainly innovation and kind of exploring what's next, almost kind of whatever your time frame is, but particularly as you go that much further out, as you think that much more kind of disruptive, because, you know, by definition, as you go further out, well, your knowledge is decreasing, right? Your level of uncertainty is increasing. Well, then I think how you answer that and how you start to give clarity or to make the ambiguous more concrete is a process of triangulation, because there's no right answer. There's no one, the magic process, I don't think. But it is the ability to try kind of triangulate from different sources, different insights, different data, to be able to kind of join the dots and say, okay, well, this plus this plus this equals X, and makes me think, well, hang on, this is the opportunity to go away. So there's a sort of an ability to join the dots across very disparate sources of data. Then back to that human point, there's an ability to persuade others around that, because I think innovation, again, is always a sales job. In whatever context you're in, startup or corporate, it's always a sales job. You're always persuading someone to go and do something they weren't doing before, again, by definition. So the ability to join the dots, that humanity piece, I think giving clarity is then very so important, because, again, you're doing something that is exploratory and so ambiguous and kind of fluffy, which is great for certain kind of people like me. Love that exploring in that kind of ambiguous space. But that's not much use when you need to go and move forwards, right? And you need to execute against that. So that ability to give clarity, so you take something highly ambiguous and then make it concrete and make both the end goal clear of this is why we're doing this and this is where we want to get to and why, but then also to make super clear the next steps of this is how we're going to execute against it, so that it feels concrete and others can kind of join in on that journey and, you know, from that open exploration, but know what to go and execute and why.
And do you have any kind of tips, tricks, kind of processes that you go through on that last step of kind of keeping that momentum going, keeping the energy alive? Is there anything that you can kind of give us an insight to about how you do that, I wonder?
I suppose, yes. I think, and the answer is not, here's a set methodology. I'm always rather suspicious of kind of innovation methodologies, because they all sound totally different and have different funky names, but are fundamentally 90% the same. And, you know, which is true and good. So the flow of them is good. But I'm never sort of wedded, I think, particularly to one set methodology. But in terms of how you bring others along with you on that journey and excite them around them, one of it, and again, I suppose particularly in a corporate context, one of them actually is almost counterintuitive, which is to stop before you start. Everyone gets excited, you know, when you're starting an innovation project and wants to jump straight to the fun bit, which is have ideas and anything goes, and, you know, it's enjoyable. It's different, you know, to many people's day job often in a corporate context. But actually, that's where so many innovation projects fail, is they fail to understand what success is for a given project, a given idea, a given initiative, and to align everyone around that, both, you know, core project team members or kind of adjacent people who'll be involved in projects, and of course, all the different stakeholders who are going to be judging this idea ultimately, or this project, or being involved in it, or crucially, being responsible for executing it, is often people see those as two separate things and different teams that, you know, must not talk to each other until there's some sort of magical handover moment. But that kind of never ends well. So how do you involve everyone at the beginning? And that is proper understanding of what given project or given initiative is and isn't going to do, what's in and out of scope, what does success look like? And then being able to kind of keep reminding people about that, because inevitably that will change, or kind of where the project is looking and what the answer is will change. But if you've got that right kind of scope at the beginning, that is a great way of being able to hold people to it and kind of keep pointing back to, well, what is success? So that, I think that's one huge piece. Another would be around kind of the mindset that both you yourself have, and just as importantly, that you are bringing out in others. And I think there are two mindsets in that sense. One is simply an expanse, and this is kind of classic innovation kind of theory, but I think it's so useful actually, which is, one is an expansive mindset where, okay, we're in creative mode right now. We're generating ideas or insights or possibilities or, you know, or pivots or kind of, it applies at many different stages of a process, but fundamentally we're being generative. And what we need right now is everyone, projects, team members, leaders, stakeholders, to be in a generative mode of understanding, okay, right now we're exploring possibilities and we're creating opportunities. And then now we're switching and now we're going reductive, now we're making decisions and now we're filtering, right? And it's that ability to both yourself and crucially in your team and stakeholders to kind of signal to them what mode they should be in right now. Are we in kind of generative mode or in reductive mode? That I think is so, it sounds so simple, but actually it's so crucial. And throughout any kind of creating anything new, you're constantly switching between those two mindsets. But where you get into problems, I think, is when you've got different people in the team or different stakeholders in different mindsets. You know, we're generating ideas, but someone wants to start judging straight away, for example. So mindset is huge. And then simply, perhaps the last one would be, and again, not a new insight, but build to learn, right? Which is, and again, even more true right now when with all the kind of tools we have, you know, at our disposal right now today, thanks to AI. But in corporate life, there's just such a strong fear of failure, both kind of at the team level, but also at kind of the exec level, that everybody, but particularly execs, you know, they want certainty in you know, quotes, which for them comes from, you know, research and ever more PowerPoints and kind of, you know, spending money to reduce uncertainty, which is great in a way. But a lot of that is done often to delay decision making. And actually also defers the act of building, when actually it's by building, whether that's MVP or prototype or pilot or whatever experiment, whatever you want to call it, it's the act of building that truly is when you get learning. And certainly for me, that was what I've always found so interesting, having worked sort of half my career with, you know, Western multinationals who want to, you know, who think nothing of writing massive checks to, you know, to Nielsen or big research houses as a way of kind of de-risking innovation. But perhaps not always kind of spending the money the best. But you know, there's this fear of failure and this, and therefore an acceptance of kind of high dollar values and lengthy kind of project times. And then working in Asia and working, you know, Asian corporates, particularly Chinese corporates, in my case, for example, where it's a completely different attitude to risk. There, it's simply about, okay, once a decision has been made, then it's the whole, the organization swings into action. And there's less of this kind of siloed nature you see in the Western side. And in Chinese multinationals or Chinese nationals, you see them moving so fast, there's a much higher acceptance of risk, essentially, because they're very happy to move fast, to launch in market, not necessarily the perfect product, and see what happens, right? And see what sticks against the wall, and then iterate and improve, which is much more like a startup in some ways, right? As opposed to perhaps slower moving and more risk-averse Western multinationals. So I've always enjoyed observing that difference and seeing what can be done from the inside to try and reduce the difference.
And I guess, you know, I'm also looking at the time, and unfortunately I know we could dive into so many different things that you've been talking about, but on the point that you're saying about, you kind of, you've, you know, you've been in lots of different things, from innovation, kind of consultancy, to in-house, to, you know, things more kind of Europe-based, perhaps, you know, more Asia-based. You've seen a lot of different things, and the way things are done. And perhaps we'll kind of go back to what you're saying at the beginning. But, you know, when you're looking around at different industries, different, you know, innovations that are happening, whether in the kind of space that you are now or just in the wider world in general, when you're going about your day-to-day, you know, where do you see there to be opportunities to reinvent, you know, the way things are done? Where, what do you think almost could be done or should be done about the how side of it?
So, okay, that's interesting. So, and I think we touched on bits of that, certainly in terms of how are you using these new tools, these new superpowers that all of us are getting, and how are you using them well? Because if you're not using them, then, you know, you can be pretty sure someone else is, and therefore is going to be able to move, you know, much faster than you. So there's that huge question. And again, whoever you are, startup or corporate or consultant or anything in between, kind of what are those tools and how are those adopted? I think that to me is a huge piece of the house, certainly.
No, fantastic. And I guess with that, kind of, I've gone through all the big questions that I wanted to ask you. We've got a few quick fire questions kind of at the end, less to do with, you know, what's kind of interesting you, but more about you, so we learn a little bit about kind of you as a person. So, you know, final quick fire questions. The first one being, you know, Do you think your friends could explain what you do well if we asked?
Okay, this one's funny. So it's definitely a running joke with both my friends and my family that they can never explain kind of what they do. So I often sort of put them on the spot to sort of see what they say kind of out of interest. Yes, they, no is the short answer. No, they cannot. What would I like them to say, I think, is very simple. That is, you know, that to help companies move faster, right, and to do new things. I think that would be the pithy way of putting it. But what that means, I think, is, a strange concept to certainly my friends and family, despite my many attempts to explain.
That's quite funny. But at least kind of you've given them the short script and be like, okay, please say this. And then, you know, they can interpret that the way they want to as well. I guess my next question is, what is the best piece of advice that you have ever been given?
That's a great one. And I think, many actually, I can think of. If I pick one, I think it would be from when I was definitely early in my career. And it was to be very intentional in terms of studying the people around you. And, you know, because obviously all of us learn, you know, as junior folks starting careers, you learn from the senior folk around you, right? Obviously easier when everyone's in the office, not remote. But fundamentally, you know, still true. So the advice I was given simply was very carefully study the different characters and techniques and tools and simply kind of ways of being of the people you admire, the senior people around you, in kind of whether that's, you know, in your company or your partners or clients, customers. And then kind of look at that and, you know, recognize both, you know, the good bits and the kind of bad bits and almost treat those as your own toolkit from which you can steal and what you want to either avoid, if I don't want to look like that guy, or I love the way that she does that. I'm going to try and build my skill set around that in terms of whatever it might be, a given skill, be that a hard skill or, you know, even more importantly, probably a soft skill. So I think it's that kind of study very carefully and then steal with glee from those around you to build obviously your own flavor and your own way of being, right? It's not like there's one right answer for one person to copy. It's that kind of stealing from many different people and places to build for who you are and kind of how you want to be as you grow and evolve your career. But I love that kind of the intentionality of that advice in terms of studying people carefully, then steal with glee to build your own toolkit.
Of course, I know you literally just said it's not, you know, one person or one thing, but is there anyone in your life that you said, you know, they've influenced the way that you think and the way that you do things? Is there someone in particular that pops out for you?
So I think I've been lucky to have had many mentors, in kind of different jobs and different parts of the world. I think I've been lucky in having many, actually, rather than kind of one person. Certainly on the kind of not the reading side of things, so kind of not first-hand knowledge, but kind of knowledge gained secondhand, you know, you can look, well, there'll be a long list. So, you know, Eric Ries, for example, you know, the kind of classic lean startup thing was, you know, that whole movement was relatively early on in my career, was a great influence. So one I definitely valued and, you know, still holds true, I think, even, you know, it's relatively old now, almost, you know, almost 15 years old. But I think many of the principles of that approach hold very true.
Wonderful. Well, I have two more questions for you. And the first one is, you know, what's something that you couldn't live without?
That's a really interesting one. So I always try and experiment with things. So I try and mix things up. Honestly, and I didn't actually put this on intentionally, but honestly, it might well be my digital watch, which I'm a massive lover of Casio watches. So this is the F91W, which is like the classic 1980s Casio digital watch that, you know, certainly if you're of an age, everyone was wearing at school, and which, you know, I have in black and silver and gold. And I absolutely love it, both for its look, but also because I think it's, you know, one of the kind of classic designs. So for me, it's got exactly the right functionality, whether I want to just tell the time or wake up or run a marathon. You know, like it's got, you know, I don't need a smartwatch. This is exactly what I love. But I do enjoy experimenting. So I always try new things. So my current, to show you my other wrist again, this wasn't intentional for today. I'm trying out a Whoop at the minute, which is a screenless kind of tracker. For me, I can't think of anything worse than, you know, my emails or a Teams message popping up on my wrist. So I was like, well, okay, what is a screenless tracker or ring, you know, or as well? What does that start to look like and how useful is that in kind of daily life and over exercising? So I always like to have an experiment, which, you know, come and go. But I think Casio watch might well be the thing I love most.
And I like the thing that you're saying, it always comes back to all the way at the beginning, saying, you know, what the different interfaces or non-interfaces that you can have when you're kind of moving into new tech. So yeah, comes back around. But yeah, no, the last question that I have for you is a bit of an odd one, but everyone on the podcast gets asked it with wildly varying answers. Johnny, on a scale of 1 to 10, how weird are you and why?
How weird. I like that. That's a wonderfully subjective question, obviously, because I think, yeah, one person's weirdo is another man's, you know, dullard, probably. But I love the question. So how weird am I from 1 to 10? So I think certainly in our kind of line of work, and if you want to be innovating and doing things differently, I think you have to be a bit weird. And I think actually, I think that's both to be naturally attracted to that line of work, and it's kind of constant changing. You know, not many things affect, so you're not often doing the same project twice. Maybe that's a bit weird. But I think also to do that project well, or to do that work well, you need to have lots of experiences. You need to, you know, if the act of creating The act of creating is, going back to that point I made earlier, is the ability to join the dots and join new ways. You know, that is most people's literal, Picasso, for example, their literal definition of creativity is to steal things you've seen in different places and connect them or join them in new ways. Well, to do that, I think you have to be a bit weird as well. And I think the more weird you are, the more, or certainly for me, as I interpret that anyway, the more open you are to new experiences, which is certainly something I very consciously, A, love doing, but, you know, kind of try and cultivate, something we all need to force ourselves out of our comfort zones. I think that is a key, I think that's a prerequisite of certainly doing the kind of jobs I always like to do. So yeah, I'd say pretty weird, and certainly a love of new things and of experimenting. But for me, that is, you know, that the weirdness could be anything from, you know, I have a deep rooted love of the strongest cheese imaginable. So, you know, mild cheese is not for me, stronger the better, through to, I don't know, backpacking in some pretty sketchy parts of the world. I thoroughly enjoy, you know, all through to, I'm always trying to write a novel, but, you know, I've got about 10 different first drafts, the first chapters on my computer, but, you know, kind of failing, but one day I'll get there. So I do think that kind of, I do think diversity of input is essential for the job and something I love, but also probably makes you a bit weird as well.
No, I absolutely love that. And yeah, I guess not just the last answer, but everything that we've talked about so far, thank you so much for kind of sharing. I know from the first question that I asked, there's so many things that we could have kind of deep dived in on and, you know, explored just, you know, the first point that you made on a whole podcast. So thank you for giving us lots of little things to kind of go away and think about. And, you know, I know the audience, if they kind of picked up on one thing that they've been thinking about for a while now, or, you know, they want to talk to you about more, they know kind of where to reach out and kind of where there is someone who's thinking about it in lots of different ways. So, you know, thank you so much for sharing.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for the time.
As we close out another episode, make sure to like, subscribe and follow us on our social channels. Want to access Label Sessions for your brand? Whether you want to build new products, access world-class mentors for your team, or reinvent the way you attract talent into your business, visit Label Sessions to find out more.